This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
When the truth feels blurred under inches of snow and a mountain of doubt, the courtroom becomes the only place left to dig. In the case of Karen Reed, the prosecution claims this is a clear-cut vehicular homicide, maybe even second-degree murder, that she hit Boston police officer John O'Keefe with her SUV in a drunken haze or rage, depending on which charges you want to believe, and left him to die. The defense on the other side argues that she's not just innocent. She's the fall girl in a cover-up orchestrated to protect those inside that house. Two drastically different stories. One, a shattered taillight. No camera rolling when it all went down. Today on Hidden Killers, we're joined by former prosecutor and criminal defense attorney Eric Fanis to break down how the case is being built and unbuilt in real time. Eric, let's start with the heart of all of this. The case hinges not on someone seeing what happened, but on how jurors interpret what Karen Reed may have said, felt, or even implied in a moment of crisis. As a legal expert here, how dangerous is it when a case leans more on emotional interference than direct evidence? And is that ever enough to convict beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yeah, Tony, in nearly every case, the jury's going to be focused on what the defendant did, what the defendant said, what the defendant's demeanor was, because they believe that that will give them some insight into what the defendant knows in terms of what played out. That being said, we've always got to be cautious when a jury is considering that type of emotional evidence, because direct, hard, concrete evidence that is sound, that is solid, that's not open to misinterpretation. Whereas a human being's words and how they are emoting is.
Very, very true. And there's so many things that, like, everyone's just trying to dissect. What did Karen Reed mean by this? How did she feel at this point in time? And the trouble with that, I don't know that Karen knows how she felt at this point in time or what she said at that point in time, because she's contradicted herself so many times. And they're really starting to lay that out in court with the video clips. Are kind of accenting each witness at this time from the prosecution with, here's another clip, or a couple, like you said this here, you said that there, and none of it seems to add up. The biggest one of all, and it's the same one from the first case, did I hit him? I hit him. Could I have hit him? All of that. And the defense is really trying to steer into all of those witnesses and say, but did she actually say that? Or did you hear someone say that? And we've had some witnesses already say, yeah, I heard her say that. That's exactly what I heard as I was sitting there trying to make John O'Keefe breathe again from an EMS worker. You have others who said, I heard it from somebody else. You're going to keep hearing all the same stuff of all over the place.
Operations to combat illegal fentanyl threatening the United States.
Does it matter? I don't know what the hell that sound was. I'm thinking this might be
cocaine and other bulk illicit.
I don't know. I don't know what that was. But
I don't have any windows open.
I don't either. I just turned mine down. But anyway, continuing on. What do you think of that? With the fact that there's so many witnesses that are saying different things, or yes, I heard it, no, I didn't hear it. Does this change it? Is this just as confusing as the last time to a jury?
Think about for a second when a person was in a prior, somewhat chaotic situation. I don't know if it's, they see an altercation at a sports game or something like that, and try to, if you ask five different people what they saw and heard, you might get five different answers. Mm-hmm. These are chaotic circumstances. Recollection is imperfect. Mm-hmm. And especially when the prosecution wants to kind of hang their hat on some statement allegedly made at the scene that may have been heard correctly, may have been misheard. Mm-hmm. Those things sound kind of shaky to me. That is just not the most solid ground on which to base a conviction, in my opinion.
No, and the thing is, in interviews with Karen, she does go on to say, to talking about saying, if I did it, basically, or did I do this? There's a lot of variations that she said herself. And sometimes it's bizarre because the clips that we see from the interviews, in some sentences, she directly contradicts herself, where she's saying, basically, I said this, but I knew it was this or that. It's bizarre because it's hard to track for myself or for anyone else, and especially for a jury, where at the end of the day, it seems to come down to, I don't know that Karen knows what she said. Other people seem to have some recollection of a semblance of what she said, but does it really matter at the end of the day if she said that aloud or not?
I think that that's an important question because, you know, think about the scene at the time. There's a dead police officer who is freezing, whose body is freezing out in the cold. He was allegedly in a house with a bunch of police officers. There's what some people think is sort of a disgruntled partner. This is a chaotic scenario. And so, you know, even if someone said at the scene, I hit him. Did I hit him? I mean, it would be difficult for Kara Reid to even know whether, you know, conclusively, whether she did actually hit him if the impact was alleged to be on the back of the vehicle, which it was. And so, you know, for someone who's just uttering what is coming to mind in this chaotic, emotionally charged situation, sometimes that can ring true. Sometimes that can be the most true statement there is. Other times that can be just sort of a garbled, confused expression that comes out of a person under really chaotic circumstances.
Yeah, and I can honestly see it either way. I don't know that it has a whole lot of meaning other than somebody trying to figure out what just happened. The shocking part is when it sways the other way eventually of like, that's impossible, that couldn't have happened, where no, it's very plausible. It could have happened. We don't know for sure, but it's at least plausible, where Karen goes back and forth on that. Another point that they were making early on in the prosecution is the fact that she was hospitalized for a psychiatric evaluation that morning while they were recovering John O'Keefe and looking at that crime scene. The prosecution trying to use it as indirect evidence of guilt. But in your experience, you know, how cautious should juries be about interpreting raw emotion as an indicator of criminal responsibility? The fact that she was taken out to a psychiatric ward, I would think even if you didn't do this and you find out your partner is dead on the ground, even if you're in a rocky situation, I'd probably be needing to go to a psych ward too.
Tony, that's the thing, is that this psychiatric evaluation that happened after the incident, it's equally plausible that that could show a person who is, you know, guilt-ridden and beside themselves for what they've done, or a person who is confused and befuddled by mm-hmm. what has gone on and their partner is deceased now. And so I think the prosecution needs to be careful with how they try to play this, because I think a juror might get offended by an argument by the prosecution that, oh, she needed therapeutic care after this, therefore that means she did it. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean she did it.
Well, there's so much of that where it's evidence of guilt. And I get that does exist. But do you feel, in your opinion thus far, are they playing that card too strong where, see, this shows evidence of guilt? They're not like outright saying that. They're kind of letting the jury let it land and let them kind of simmer on it and figure it out. But you can tell that's a lot of the direction they're going, again, because a lot of this is circumstantial. Are they playing that hand too hard so far?
Sort of the insinuation seems to be something close to kind of stigmatizing a person seeking mental health. Mm-hmm. You know, if a person needs some help, especially under such dire, oppressive circumstances, that's, you know, holding that against them at a criminal trial in mm-hmm. a death case, I just really think a jury might be rubbed the wrong way by that. And the prosecution, it's not the strongest evidence. It could be interpreted multiple ways. And so I think the prosecution should focus on some of the other evidence that would be more sound and that comports with sort of the objective reality and investigation analysis that took place after the incident.
We are starting to see more pieces in the trial of Karen Reid that go beyond just the psychological, beyond just did I hit him, could I have hit him, and all of that. Tail light, that's been a big one. We've heard so many pieces of evidence from each side. One side claiming, you know, we found these pieces of tail light right by John O'Keefe's body. The defense then saying, that was planted. Somebody got there and they planted those broken pieces of taillight because in the Sally port, it looks like somebody was messing with the vehicle. Well, now we have direct evidence of Karen Reed talking about picking up pieces of taillight while she was there at that scene. Not a situation where somebody snuck back in and dropped taillight there. I mean, that would be kind of impossible at that moment in time. But the fact that she herself is recounting taillight at the scene of where she hit John O'Keefe. Does that completely destroy the conspiracy theory of the taillight being planted at the scene of the crime?
It's surely problematic for defense to argue that this was planted later on when Karen Reed herself appears to have acknowledged that she was picking up taillight pieces at the scene. And then not only does it undermine the defense's conspiracy argument with regard to the taillight, but it undermines the entire conspiracy argument. If we can't believe Karen Reed regarding what happened to the taillight and the pieces on the ground, how can we believe what her team is saying regarding some, you know, really vague, unarticulated incident that happened inside this house with a bunch of police officers?
And that's the problem with so much of this case. It's word salad. Karen, she just talks and talks and talks. And it seems she said almost every variation of this story other than I hit him on purpose or any. Obviously, she would never do that. But she's said variations to, you know, could I have and things like that. And it's hard to believe anything she says because it seems that when she tells a story, it changes from place to place. One of the more recent ones that we just saw in court was about drinking. And I don't know if we learned much of anything other than I think Karen Reed probably has a drinking problem. Just from what we saw. I don't know for true or for fact, but, you know. But she talks, she said so many different things about how much she drank that night. One interview, it's four drinks. And another interview, It's six or seven drinks. In one interview, it's every 40 minutes. It's a vodka and tonic. And then in a very long piece of unedited tape that we got from the ID discovery crew that was played in court, she goes on to explain in a very complicated way how many drinks she had that night, literally counting them in a way seemingly only an alcoholic could. It's literally rational. Like, well, it wasn't strong enough in my view, so I got a shot on the side. And then I poured that into my drink. So we learned she had even more drinks. But she says because it didn't hit her, well, then it must be not that strong of a drink. She's basically saying the bartender didn't put a vodka in her drink, which they did. And then she adds more vodka to that drink because it's not strong enough for her. And then by the end of the night, she's got like three or four shots in a drink, and then they take it with them to go. So many contradictions, so many ways of justifying how much she was drinking or not justifying how much she was drinking. It's all over the board. In her own estimations, again, I'm not calling her an alcoholic, but the way she described that shit was the way an alcoholic would describe it. Just so much rationalization. It shouldn't take you 10 minutes to explain how much you had to drink. What is it? What's the number? But she has a lot of difficulty getting there. Again, a big point where it's not necessarily about the murder, but it does go to her credibility of what you can believe out of her mouth because it changes. And she says it every time with some sort of conviction, even though the story seems to change.
Tony, absolutely. And from a defense perspective, oftentimes less is more. Your client can talk themselves out of an acquittal. You know, this case is questionable. It is not a slam dunk. It resulted in a mistrial the first time. But some of these statements Karen Reed has made since then, like you said, go to whether the jury can believe anything she's saying. And she didn't have to do all these interviews, you know, especially the media ones. And so, you know, the inconsistencies, the discrepancies, those start to cast kind of a black cloud on the defense. And the jury's looking at everything the defense is saying now with a raised eyebrow because, you know, if we can't believe her on a simple question of how many drinks did you have, how can we believe her on other details that are germane to the charges in the case?
Exactly. And that this is what's new about this case, because the first time we didn't have every witness accented at the end with Karen Reed making a contradictory statement, as we do this time. And I'm just wondering how that's going to play to the jury when they consistently see inconsistent statements over and over and over again in this case. I mean, how, that's got to be making an impact early on, far more than it did in round one.
Totally. You know, I think in round one, like you said, they didn't have all of these inconsistent subsequent statements. And so, you know, the jurors approached it with an open mind and they heard the prosecution and they heard the defense and they gave them, you know, what appears to be a fair shake in terms of saying, hey, could this conspiracy have happened? Does it result in reasonable doubt? Here, I think the prosecution is smart to sort of color the lens through which the jury is going to view all of these subsequent evidence in the case with these inconsistent statements by Karen Reed. It makes them seem like liars. And you know, that is not something you want to seem like when you're a defendant on trial in a death case.
No, not at all. I left him there. That's the words that she allegedly spoke to Peggy O'Keefe, John's mom, when she went by and visited the house later that day to collect some of her things, which of course you do when you may have just killed your boyfriend. Like, let me go to the house and get my stuff, my curler. I don't know what she took, but it seems more like, and I've been saying this all along, it feels to me like Karen Reed mentally is treating this like a breakup more than he's dead. You know, you show up to the mom's house, to his house where mom's at, you know, can you go upstairs and get some stuff? And mom's like, why is she here? It's very cold. It's very bizarre. I don't know what she would need at that moment in time from his house that you need to go collect your belongings from your dead boyfriend at that moment in time. But it's not a great look, especially with the testimony that Peggy O'Keefe gave the other day. And none of it was very warm towards Karen. Like, I don't know that there was ever any sort of warm relationship there, but I don't know how things actually were between John and his mom, because there's reports there too that, you know, it was, you know, maybe a little on and off. Again, doesn't mean like she hated him or he hated her, but, you know, some people just don't have the tightest of relationships. What did you glean from Peggy's testimony and the "I left him there"?
From Peggy's testimony, one of the takeaways, like you said, is Karen Reed's aloofness. She seems to be like, she doesn't appreciate the gravity of what's happened.
Yeah.
Her demeanor doesn't match what people would expect to see from someone who has just innocently lost their partner. You know, she appeared, like I said, detached, sometimes callous, cold. My gosh. And that plays in the prosecution's theme. They're saying that she, you know, essentially hit her partner with a car and drove off and didn't even care about him. And then you have this statement, you know, "I left him there." That has multiple interpretations. It could be that she left him there to die out in the snow. It could be that she left him at the house and they were in a fight, so they parted ways. But all of these things are starting to really create an impression as to Karen Reed's character. I'm worried the jury is going to use that impression of her character in their deliberations to Karen Reed's detriment.
Yeah, and this is a clip that was played in front of the jury right a little bit after Peggy's testimony. Just showing Karen's demeanor, even more so shockingly. Let's just take a look at this quick.
And his mother leans over the kitchen island and says to me, "I think he looks like he got hit by a car. He looks like he got hit by a car." I'm like, wait a minute. Were you both looking at the same body?
Yeah, I think she was. And she's her mom, or she's his mom. So mom's trying to figure out what the hell happened. I again, it's a disconnect. It's a disconnect from the gravity of what's going on that one can say that about the mom in that sort of way. It doesn't agree with Karen, because she doesn't want to be accused of being the person who hit him with the car. The police looked at it and thought, no, he was hit by a car. But obviously the police have a lot of other credibility issues, but I can't imagine that played well to a jury.
In looking at that, where is the empathy? You know, that the jury wants to see that Karen Reed is at least a decent human being who's not going to mow down a partner with a car and drive off in a blizzard. And here, Karen Reed is kind of in a mocking fashion, sort of making fun of the victim's mother on national television. I just think anyone who looks at that is going to say, what is with this gal? There is a lack of empathy, an aloofness, and a callousness that, unfortunately for Karen Reed, plays directly into the prosecution's theory and theme.
We're going to see more evidence admitted here, and one of those points is going to be about John O'Keefe's cell phone. And I know we're going to have two contradicting stories here of what happened with the phone. I know round one, there's one expert saying it went up and down three flights of stairs or something to that nature. This time, we're going to have temperature data introduced into this that's going to show how hot or cold the phone was. And I'm going to assume that this data is going to show that the phone, once leaving Karen's vehicle, as one cell expert says, it didn't move much after that. And then its temperature basically shows it went into a freezing cold environment and never left it. That's a new one. That's a piece that we didn't necessarily have last round in this trial. And I think that's going to be an interesting one. And I'm wondering how you think the defense is going to play that. If we're going to say he went into the house and the phone shows, I mean, unless the house was like a freezer, I don't know how you counter that.
That is an interesting new wrinkle for this round two trial. Defense is arguing in part that John O'Keefe's body did not show the typical signs of being out in a blizzard for hours upon hours upon hours. And instead that something happened inside the house and O'Keefe was later dragged outside the house. But if this cell phone shows that the cell phone stayed outside the house and in fact, got colder and colder as the hours went by, that is directly consistent with the prosecution's argument that John O'Keefe was just hit with a vehicle outside the house and left there to die. And so defense is going to have a difficult time. I mean, what could they say? I guess they could say he dropped his phone outside and he went inside. But where's the evidence of that? That sounds like speculation.
Exactly. And the data of showing where it moved to and such also, I don't know how you can have one expert saying one thing and the other saying the other, especially on a data related device. Have you run into that in your own practice with things when it comes to cell phones where just two are telling completely different stories?
This is the first time that I've seen two experts having completely different opinions, really about the same data.
Yeah.
In a cell phone context, you know, sometimes when we're talking about triangulation and GPS location mm-hmm. of witnesses, some expert might say, oh, well, it was closer to these three cell towers. No, I think it was actually closer to these other towers or whatever. But that's even a minor difference. It's not these drastically different conclusions drawn by each expert. I think it's going to be terribly confusing for the jury.
Thus far into this, what do you think has been some of the biggest wins for the prosecution and then some of the biggest wins so far for the defense? Obviously, the defense is just working on cross right now, but what in your opinion have you seen that you would say both to?
For the prosecution, I think they have done a heck of a job using as leverage Karen Reed's own statements against her. As you mentioned, that they're talking, that they're presenting inconsistent statements frequently throughout the trial to sort of develop this lens through which the jury is going to see Karen Reed and what she is arguing. On the flip side, I think defense did a pretty stellar job in opening statement. That was really impressive to me. You know, an opening statement, you're not allowed to argue. You're just allowed to present facts in a persuasive sequence. And Alan Jackson, defense attorney, was evocative. He was compelling. He was making arguments without running afoul of the argument prohibition in opening statements. So I thought it was very skilled and impactful for the jury. It's anyone's ballgame still.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.